Okay, so today I'm going to be speaking on the very first refuge. I take refuge in Buddha. I take refuge in Buddha. Such a simple phrase, yet so meaningful. But what are we taking refuge from? And to what or whom? For me, taking refuge in Buddha means finding safety or comfort from our sufferings, our separate selves, our delusions, or our stories we tell ourselves of who or what we are. And when we bow to Buddha, we are bowing to all of Buddha nature, to all beings and all things, including ourselves. Dogen wrote in his classical On the Endeavor of the Way in Shobo Genzo, quote, "Know that fundamentally you do not lack unsurpassed enlightenment, and you are replete with it continuously." Let me repeat that. Know that fundamentally you do not lack unsurpassed enlightenment, and you are replete with it continuously. But you may not realize it, and may be in the habit of arousing discriminatory views and regard them as real. So our habit of arousing discriminatory views and regarding them as real gets in the way of our own Buddha nature. Our minds and attachments get in the way, and we suffer. If ever I were able to fully take refuge in Buddha, I doubt I would need the precepts, because the ethical conduct of the precepts would naturally flow from my own Buddha nature. Fully taking refuge in Buddha would mean fully embracing and being the timeless nature of Buddha itself. Yet I am human and fallible. As is said in the Genjo Koan, in attachment, blossoms fall. In aversion, weeds spread. And attachment and aversion are very familiar to me and likely to you. So my path is clear. My ethical conduct, my precepts matter. And taking refuge in Buddha as my teacher and guide is my spiritual path. The Buddha I have come to know in my zazen, whom I have come to have faith in, is not a god or a miraculously divine being, but is a human being who healed himself and teaches me how to heal myself from my mind and stories and attachments, to liberate myself from myself, and to open my heart to the teachings of compassion and love for all beings that lie at the core of our Zen practice. In the Pali Suttas, it is said that at least one Hindu who saw Shakyamuni Buddha shortly after he finished the long meditation under the Bodhi tree and attained enlightenment tried to prostrate to him as a deity or god because his face was shining so. At that time, there was a great acceptance of and belief in numerous devas and godlike beings. The Buddha stopped him and explained that he was not a god. He made it very clear he was a human being. The man persisted, observing that Buddha was not an ordinary being, and asked what the difference was between the Buddha and ordinary people. The Buddha replied, "I am awake." This is what the Buddha is offering us. An ability to awaken, to heal, to transform our mundane lives to our Buddha nature, which is our birthright, just in being alive, as Dogen reminds us. Sometimes I feel the mystical teachings of our Buddha practice, which I fully embrace the mystical teachings, get mixed up with the miraculous and the magical, which personally don't speak that much to me. The sutras are filled with many such stories or signs of Buddhahood. I like to think of them as another form of expedient means to exemplify or represent aspects of awakening. But I really, or skillful means, but I really don't know and I cannot know. But Buddha, the mendicant turned teacher, the healer, the awakened one, speaks deeply to me. I know I need healing. I know I am lacking in my ability to fully love and have natural compassion for others. We all are. My actions or lack of actions reflect this. Not that I don't love or have compassion, but that I am limited by my own constructions that this humble healer helps me deconstruct, or by my own limited viewpoints of life or reality as I see it, rather than the all-encompassing interrelationship of all things in Buddha nature. Buddha taught us that Zazen is the Dharma gate of my practice. My attachments, my aversions, have little hold where they are not hidden, and the mind is free to be in and part of empty space, even if just for fleeting brief moments. This taking refuge in Buddha is a practice of being, and is the closest thing I know to being with Buddha, almost like the face-to-face we speak of with each other. Letting go, letting go, letting in everything, no good or bad, just everything. This is an incredibly humbling practice to resist the temptation to see my identity as something, as me, to see me as simply an amalgamation of events and circumstances and an ego which defends and defines and limits me. I know deep down I am more than that. But what is that? The refuge as spoken in the full moon ceremony is, I take refuge in Buddha before all beings, immersing body and mind deeply in the way, awakening true mind. Taking refuge in Buddha includes everything. That means even the crazy paradoxes and challenges in life, the confusions that may not make sense but exist in both the world and within me. I know my life to be a mix of a convoluted past, a present of many contradictions, and a future that seems to be narrowing. But they are all Buddha, all at once, and amazingly tolerant of each other. So taking refuge before all beings includes all the numerous egos and identities and beings I have created for myself over my lifetime. Is there a greater truth than that my own being is constantly changing and impermanent and largely made up by me at this particular point in time? In this taking of refuge to Buddha, I dissolve, Buddha dissolves, acknowledging the true mind we share and have always shared if we allow it in. In taking our places, Norman says, quote, to take refuge in the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, is to return to our own real nature as conscious human beings who were born with and have never ceased to possess, however much we may have forgotten, open minds and tender hearts. Open minds and tender hearts. He goes on, returning to Buddha is acknowledging that our inmost nature is the nature of awareness, of awakening. That awareness is the root of our consciousness and awakening is our birthright of our life. So let me repeat that. Returning to Buddha or taking refuge in Buddha is acknowledging that our inmost nature is the nature of awareness, of awakening. That awareness is the root of our consciousness, and awakening is the birthright of our life. I see this precept as a becoming, an invitation, an embrace, emerging with love, peace, and consciousness that my Zazen tells me, in my soul, is the greatest truth of the universe. Here I am truly home. I never left, but have forgotten. I have many Buddhas and Bodhisattva statues at home. Those of you who come to Shushin have seen them placed around the facility. Most of these I bought years ago on eBay from China, most of which survived the Cultural Revolution when many monasteries were ransacked and the goods stolen. One tanka I bought had so much grime and dirt on it, I thought it a complete loss, until I repeatedly and gently took a wet rag to it to reveal astonishing artwork. It is the tanka you see as my off-video representation on Zoom. Yet these are not Buddha, just reminders of or manifestations of Buddha, or the teachings that particular statues represent. My prized possession of Buddha is a lowly rock from one of our first Shishins at St. Dorothy's Rest years ago in Occidental. There was a high point there with a bench, and I spent hours on it in the dark, watching the moon and the stars, and once even a full eclipse of a red moon. But in my deep meditations there, I lost myself to the Buddha nature of everything. Everything awake and alive. And coming out of meditation in the dark, I would turn my flashlight on to find gazing eyes staring back at me, staring me down for what seemed like an eternity, by bodiless deers and owls and other creatures, far more awakened than me. It was so dark their eyes would seem to float in nothingness and gaze directly into my soul. Time and space melded. My heart softened and opened, and I was one with them. And with this remarkable rock at my feet, I have never let it go. That rock resides by my zabuton every morning alongside my calligraphy of the version of the precepts I wrote. That's the rock, just a plain rock. We often talk of bowing to Buddha, and do so many times in our services. So what is all this bowing about? I feel bowing has become a very important part of my practice over the years, and would suggest you consider it, or would consider integrating it into your practice as we go through the three refuges these next few classes, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The physical bowing is a healing practice in itself, of humility and renunciation. It is grounding and humbling to touch the forehead to the earth and raise the open palmed hand supporting the Buddha nature of all things, everything. Norman shared a bowing gata in priest practice that goes like this. Bower and what is bowed to are empty by nature. Bodies of one and another are not two. I vow with all beings to obtain liberation and to manifest the unsurpassable mind and return to the boundless truth. So bower and what is bowed to are empty by nature. I'm not bowing to a deity of Buddha, but taking refuge in all of Buddha nature and everything that exists. Bodies of one and another are not two. Of course, we are totally interconnected. I am you and you are me. We are not separate. I vow with all beings, not for myself, but with and for all beings, to obtain liberation from our own delusions and ignorance, and to manifest the unsurpassable mind, the clear mind of Buddha, and return, not to obtain, not to learn, but to return to the boundless truth, the ultimate boundless truth that has always been and always will be my birthright, right here in front of me, as Dogen and Norman say. And on the lighter side, taking refuge in Buddha means all aspects of Buddha. Sun-faced Buddha, empathetic joy Buddha, compassionate Buddha, loving Buddha, fearless Buddha, merciful Buddha, moon and a dewdrop Buddha, time and space Buddha. Buddha includes everything. Nothing is left out. Nothing can be left out. This, to me, is the mystical Buddha, the all-encompassing awakening of all beings and all things, the Buddha of precepts and practice, the Buddha of compassion and love, the beloved of the poets who can express Buddha much better than I, the healer. How utterly amazing just to be alive and conscious and to be part of this incredible mystery together. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your practice. And now we'll have a minute of silence before Jean speaks.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
It seems very fitting to be talking to you today from Santa Fe, where I am visiting, and I'm in the digital print room of a wonderful friend of mine. Fitting because I'm going to talk to you a little bit about imagination in our taking refuge in Buddha. And like John, I also like to quote from Norman. I've always loved the story that he begins, "The world could be otherwise, the path of the Bodhisattva." It's a story about a wonderful French surrealistic poet, Robert Desnos, during the Holocaust. And it's a story that Norman heard several years ago, and it goes like this, that Desnos, who was Jewish, was fighting for the resistance, was captured by the Nazis, thrown into prison camp, and was one day put on the back of a truck, knowing that he was going to the place where people were gassed. The prisoners were all completely quiet, knowing that they were going to their certain deaths. And suddenly, he jumped up and he took one of the other prisoners' hands, reading his palms, and he said, "I am so excited for you. You're going to live a very long life. You're going to have 3 children, a beautiful wife, wealth, so fantastic, so wonderful. His excitement was so contagious that first one man and then another put their hands out. "Please read my poem," they said. And each one received the same sort of prediction: long life, children, wealth, exciting career, beautiful surroundings, peace, happiness, success, unending joy. The guards couldn't believe it. The guards were completely shocked that these prisoners, who they knew they were taking to their death, were suddenly jubilant, joyous, jumping on the back of the truck with life, vitality. And then the guards actually began to have their palms read. "Read mine," they said, "read mine." And though it was just Desnos sharing his dharma, sharing his imagination, it wasn't necessarily something that people couldn't believe. The imagining was that powerful. Desnos did not die during the war. He survived. All those men on that truck survived. Desnos, unfortunately, died of typhus not too long before liberation. But it was, in fact, this story that Norman said gave him much more insight about our spiritual practice. He said, "The imagination is so powerful. It's essential for our humanness. The Bible, other religious texts, folk tales, myths, poems, plays, novels, anecdotes, music, ritual, pictures, dreams, all of it, all imaginative productions, rising up from the unconscious to expand the soul, help us feel who we really are and what the world really is, to help us move beyond our habitual, often one-dimensional perspective, our outer perceptions, our fearful emotions." Imagination, he kept saying to us in this book, and if you haven't read it, it's just a wonder. Imagination isn't an escape from reality. It deepens and enriches reality. It doesn't measure or devise or instrumentalize us. Doesn't define or manipulate. Its nature is to open, and to mystify, to light, to shock, to inspire. Imagination extends us and extends the world without limit, leaping from the known to the unknown. It plays in the deep end, where heart and love hold sway. I love that, the deep end. He reminds us that spiritual practice is one of the key sites of imagination. And if we keep remembering that the imagination is powerful, it begins to create a sort of self-validating truth strong enough to affect us, inner and outer, transformational affection. So as I thought to myself, as we begin to study the precepts, whether it's for the first time or the 10th time, can we imagine and understand, who is this Buddha? This Buddha, a word defined as awakened one, the one of an awakened heart. This precept class really is a great opportunity for all of us to remember, as John just said, to go back, to consider how our own understanding of Buddha can be so much bigger, more imaginal, not just a single human person. So over the span of a practice lifetime, it's been my experience that Buddha changes and expands, turning in me in different ways. It arises in Thich Nhat Hanh's cloud meditations, the mindfulness walks, and the sound of the bell with the sound of the han hitting the wood. And a love song that breaks open my heart. Buddha's in my overjoyed dog, welcoming me unconditionally every time I return home. It's a spontaneous enso drawn by Kaz Tanahashi. A ray of sunlight, motes of dust dancing through a window. Buddha, just as John said, everywhere, everything, everyone. Back in the 1970s, when I lived in a residential Zen center in New York, we held lively evenings of stories and skits about our study of Zen. We focused one evening on Buddha. One man told us of remembering the Buddha as a wooden doorstop at the entry of his childhood home, and how he understood and remembered that Buddha is the one who opens all the boundless Dharma gates, the ones we enter in our four bodhisattva vows. One of the skits asked us to all join hands in a long line to go outdoors and make a giant ring around a grove of trees, and then how we were all asked to lie down on the ground, being the dying Buddha, offering last words to his disciples. Our imaginings all so moving. And as I remember them, they were equally as good as the Buddha's last quoted words. Unto thine own self be a light. So many understandings of Buddha. And to me, first and foremost important, I guess, is that Buddha represents our human capacity to develop a liberated and humble mind. A mind fully free of hatred, greed, ignorance, and a generous heart that opens to sorrows as well as to joys, to not knowing what's coming next in this life, to hearing the cries of the world, trusting, courageous enough to not turn away from what's painful and difficult. Buddha is the kind enough in us, the kind enough to forgive and really forget, to love with no strings attached. So we can take refuge in this open and courageous, loving awareness. Again, as John said, and you know, we don't check these talks before we do them. They do overlap. But as he said, we take refuge not in a god or a deity, not in a single human figure, teacher, or leader. We take refuge by opening to what's happening, not how we want it to be, how we reveal our true interconnected belongingness with each other, with all beings in this precious life. There's also the historical Buddha, Gautama Buddha, a being who was the son of a king and a queen, born of a mother, Maya, who died just 7 days after his birth, raised lovingly by his mother's sister, Pajapati, the woman who would become the leader, the initiator of women practitioners, the first female ordained as a nun by the very reluctant stepson, nephew, the Buddha. The Buddha who was protected by his father and everyone in his service from encountering suffering of any kind, including illness and death. This is the Buddha who sees a dead body on the side of the road, leaves all the riches of the kingdom, leaves his wife Yasodhara and son Rahula, wanders as a mendicant for 6 years, almost starves himself to death, doing severe ascetic practices, seeking something he calls enlightenment. Something we might just think of as awakening, of freedom from our suffering. I say that because enlightenment carries so much confusion, I think, in our practice. It seems to suggest just being better than. And if anything, what awakening is really awakening to our equalness, our sameness. Even though we are unique, we're also the same. So when Buddha has his big breakthrough, it's because even though he's nearly dead from not eating, it's because he's been fed a bowl of rice porridge by a little girl who takes pity on him. Pity on him being so hungry. And then he awakens under the Bodhi tree with the morning star, saying, "Everything, just as it is the enlightened way." This is the Buddha who teaches the Dharma, walking with, supporting a community of students for more than 45 years, and finally lays down between two solid trees and tells his disciples, "Unto thine own self be a light." So this Buddha lived a human life, just like me, just like you, like all of us. He came to the end having put his best effort into being and sharing, living his true illuminated understanding of life. I especially love that it's a little girl who gifts him a bowl of rice porridge that nourishes and energizes his final push. So then there's Buddha, the basic archetype of bodhisattvas, the ones who can reach awakening, but who put it off out of compassion for others, letting others go first until all have been enlightened. So the archetype has this sort of fundamental five elements that all Bodhisattva archetypes have. The stories are about a human being's choice between worldly, spirit, or spiritual pursuits, an awakening to the truth of suffering, a home leaving, usually an ascetic practice leading to the middle way, and a complete then awakening into loving awareness. This archetypal story was part of what motivated me 40 years ago to quit my television news producer job and to leave my marriage and loft life in the West Village of New York to jump headlong into practice. Though I had not lived a sheltered life of great wealth, and I had seen a lot of sickness, death, when I saw all the suffering in war zones, I realized there was also a war zone in me, and I felt a strong desire to do something to stop it. So as I told you in a recent talk, the Buddha arose in the photograph of Suzuki Roshi on the back cover of Zen Mind Beginner's Mind and leapt the known into the unknown of my heart. Then there's Buddha as the precepts, the embodiment of the teachings. And I chose, for example, the first Dharma lesson he gave to his son, to never tell a deliberate lie, even in a jest. He added, if a person feels no shame telling a deliberate lie, there's no evil that person will not do. The Buddha saw the precept against lying as crucial to the whole of ethical conduct, to goodness of any sort. And he defined a lie as deliberately misrepresenting the truth. That is, you did X, but you say you didn't. Or you didn't see Y, but you say that you did. And when we hear this definition, we try to find exceptions like, well, I was only joking, or I was just exaggerating. I have done that very often in my life. Sometimes, though, there are lies told with what we think of as compassionate motives, wanting to protect others from truths that we think they are not ready to hear. Lies of protection. So this is Buddha as embodied courageous teachings, precepts. We keep them as best we can. We fall down and we get up. We break a precept. And then we vow to make course corrections so that we don't keep on repeating it. So what is this refuge? Well, it's not exactly a safe harbor. It's more like slowing down at a brief rest stop to remember our intention. It's like a refresher course, a renewal of our vows. Because maybe you've noticed, as I have, that when you sit down for zazen, or even when you're just taking a break to relax, all of this stuff starts coming up in your mind. Ugh, you think, I don't want to deal with this right now. And then these random, unfinished bits and pieces that need to be processed from your day or your week. You need to do a little housekeeping. You need to go back, remember who you really are. But then sometimes it's also giant things that we've really pushed down. Maybe life's moving too fast and we haven't been able to give whatever it is, the attention and the care it deserves. As we go deeper into spiritual practice, we find the more unfinished business probably becomes dislodged. But we become more experienced, more capable. We're developing that capacity that I talked about, of heart and mind. The silence of our sitting offers a spaciousness to not turn away, the chance to feel and see and be with each other. This heals our heart as well as our mind, heals our discontents, lets us practice with our friends, lets us be forgiven. All the ideas about how things should be, this is not right, this is too short, too hot, too cold, these things actually are not to be dismissed as not Buddha, not in the place of refuge. They are actually the things that bring us back to connect us to our true Buddha nature, to our goodness, a wholeness in us. Oh yeah, it's not the way I think it should be. Oh yeah, it's not like I get my way all the time. Ah, it's better than I thought. Yeah, it's in the imaginings, in the hopes, in the ways that I see, it could be different. Often it is. Knowing we don't live in the mind. We rest in the heart. And we let the mind come and go as it will. This can be a refuge. The discovering something so fundamental to us, we often lose sight of it. The ground of our being. How it allows life to open, be felt, be touched, be received. To be in touch with what we really care about, the acceptance of ourselves, no longer dominated by self-evaluation and self-criticism. I think to myself, everyone suffers, just like me. And I try, when I can remember, to do this simple little Tibetan practice that I think I learned it from Pema Chodron years ago. You look around in the world, and you look in such a way that you imagine and recognize how every being you encounter is already awakened. That the entire world around us is awakened, all except one being who thinks they are alone and disconnected from all the awakening. The only being who's not awakened being yourself. And all of these other beings are appearing, being imagined in various forms as bodhisattvas of mercy and compassion to help you, to help me awaken, to awaken our patience and our tenderness, our capacity to love with no strings attached. This feels like refuge in Buddha to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean. So now we'll just take again 1 minute of silence, and then we'll work on going into our breakout rooms.